the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. On March 17th and 24th, 2003, we aired a two-part interview with James Loewen on what he identified as lies we had been taught about our history in our textbooks and at our national historic sites and monuments. It caused quite a stir. Well, he's back with another provocative topic, sundown towns, or communities wherein local policies and practices excluded the presence of African Americans, Hispanics, Jews, and other minorities after dark. Loewen will be discussing his work with Talking History's Lena Place. Fiona Beatty will join us after that to tell us about a new and very popular museum exhibit on slavery, and Michael Farquhar will offer us the seventh in his 10-part series of readings from his book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But as it's the first week of Black History Month, I'd like to devote my weekly segment, History in the News, to a new historical museum, a new museum exhibit, and a recently released film, all related to Black history, and all of which you might want to catch. I'll be back in a moment to do just that. You're listening to Talking History. Just in time for Black History Month, an international museum has opened in San Francisco that is committed to showcasing what it calls the best of the best from the African diaspora. The Museum of the African Diaspora intends to reach out and initiate collaborative ventures with institutions of similar vision from around the world. And it already has done so with the British Museum, the Museum of African Art in New York, and the University of California at Berkeley. Drawing from the collections of museums, institutes, organizations, universities, and private citizens, MOAD will be a repository of information to be shared with all who wish to know more about the African diaspora. Embracing the newest applications in media technology, it features interactive and immersive exhibits that enable visitors, in person or online, to exchange histories and stories, debate viewpoints from around the world, and find common ground. For information on the Museum of the African Diaspora and its schedule of exhibits and programs, go to www.moadsf.org. Rosa Parks has been much in the news lately due to her unfortunate passing, but we should be reminded that there were others involved in the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 that helped launch the civil rights movement that swept across the South. And I'm not referring to Martin Luther King Jr., who became its primary voice, but to little-known people like Claudette Kelvin, who was arrested for refusing to give up her seat on a city bus to a white passenger 9 months before Rosa Parks' same act of defiance. Kelvin and others, along with Parks and King, are featured in a new Smithsonian Institution traveling exhibit, 381 Days, The Montgomery Bus Boycott Story, that has just opened at the Alabama State Capitol and that will tour the country for 4 years. For more information, go to www.sites.si.edu. And finally, coming to a theater near you, hopefully, a new film on the life and death of Emmett Lewis Till. Till, you'll recall, was the 14-year-old African-American from Chicago who was spending the summer of 1955 with his relatives in Mississippi when he was murdered for whistling at a white woman. His mother's insistence on displaying his horribly mutilated body in an open casket was a galvanizing moment in American race relations. Watch for The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till. When we return, Talking History's Lena Place talks with James Loewen about sundown towns. This is Talking History. It's no secret that long after discrimination against people on the basis of race, religion, or national origin was unconstitutional, other, less visible ways of excluding such people from white Christian communities continued to exist. That's the subject of James Loewen's latest research. Lena Place spoke with him recently about what he found.
Racial discrimination and exclusion have pervaded American life throughout most of our history, despite constitutional guarantees and legal decree. One of the least documented but very pervasive forms of institutionalized racism has been those policies that barred African Americans, Hispanics, Jews, and other minorities from communities after sundown. Our guest today, James Loewen, describes this hidden dimension of American racism in his recent book, Sundown Towns. James Loewen is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Vermont and the author of a number of books on America's hidden history. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, glad to be here.
Let's start off with a very basic explanation. What is a sundown town?
A sundown town is a town that for many decades, and some of them still do, kept out blacks, kept them from living there, from renting there, and therefore kept them out after dark. And you get the term sundown towns because many of these towns in the Midwest and in the Ozarks and in California and Oregon actually had signs at their city limits that typically said, quote, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you," in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, for instance, or in Hawthorne, California, or in Pekin, Illinois, three towns that had such signs.
You describe a long historic arc that is familiar, noting that improved racial relations after the conclusion of the Civil War, but then things grew much worse, moving into a long period that you call the Nadir. What was going on in that period?
Right after the Civil War, we had this more or less wonderful period known as Reconstruction. And I argue that Reconstruction occurred in the North as well as the South. Now, of course, the North didn't have to be politically reconstructed the way the South did after the Southern states left the United States. But there was this springtime of freedom, this period of anti-racism that's codified for us in the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, the Equal Rights Amendment and the Voting Rights Amendment. And that kind of lasted, dwindling, but kind of lasted until 1890. But then between 1890 and 1940, we have this period, the nadir of race relations. And, of course, that's the word N-A-D-I-R. Mm-hmm. We're not talking Ralph here. The opposite of zenith, the low point of race relations, in which I think racism as an ideology went to its high point, I think higher even than during the slavery era. And during this period, many, many towns across the North expelled their black populations in tiny little race riots in little places like Anna, Illinois, and Decatur, Indiana, and town after town across the Midwest, across the Ozarks, the Cumberlands in Tennessee, places in Oregon. And so that was the growth of sundown towns. So they're a rather recent phenomenon.
What precipitated that? What were some of the concerns, the anxieties?
Well, I think the underlying things that were going on were three that eroded our anti-racist idealism from the Civil War. And these three were, first of all, the Indian Wars. We continued to take land from the Western Indians. When we discovered gold on it, blam, we took land from the Lakotas or in Colorado. And we were able to take it because they weren't white. So it's kind of hard to say, well, black folks should have all civil rights and political rights, even though they're not whites. But Indians shouldn't. That's a little contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, we had this ideology known as imperialism that we didn't really invent it. It swept over the United States from Britain and from Western Europe. But we bought into it, and we took Hawaii, and then in 1898, after the Spanish-American War, the next year we turned on our Filipino allies and attacked them and took the Philippines and, of course, took Puerto Rico and so on. And then the third factor, underlying factor, I think, is immigrants in two different ways. First, we kept getting these Chinese immigrants in the West, and the Republicans tried to be unracist about it and welcome them and so on. But the Democrats, and of course the Democratic Party was the party of overt white supremacy throughout the 19th century and indeed into the 1920s, called themselves a white man's party. They argued for Chinese exclusion. And then on the other coast, they kept getting the votes of Italian Americans, Jewish Americans, Slavic Americans, folks coming from Eastern Europe, despite whatever the Republicans could do. And so the Republicans gradually became nativist and started arguing WASPs are better than these groups I just mentioned. Well, you can't really argue that one group is better than another and it follows that they deserve more privileges while still maintaining that we should have equal rights for all despite race. And so I think those three factors undermined the Republican commitment to racial equality. And by 1891, the Republicans gave up on it.
And as you've already indicated, even though we might conventionally assume that sundown towns were a Southern phenomenon, that wasn't the case at all, was it?
No. All kinds of people have said to me when I'm told him over the last 5 years what I was researching. Oh, yes, down in Mississippi, right? Well, no. I lived in Mississippi for 8 years, and so I tried to locate every last sundown town in Mississippi. And I believe I located six. Now, in Illinois, which is the state that I grew up in, and therefore I did a little more research in Illinois than in any other single state, in Illinois, I believe I've located 472 sundown towns,
goodness,
which is a majority of all communities in the state. And I think a similar majority of all communities occurs in Indiana, in Oregon, and in many other northern states. The traditional South was aghast at the process, the white South. Why would you do that? Why would you make your maid leave? Why would you make your cotton pickers, your agricultural labor force leave? So they generally didn't do it.
How'd you become interested in this topic?
Well, you know, when I was in college, I went to Carleton College up in Minnesota, and friends of mine were, of course, from the Twin Cities and the suburbs of the Twin Cities. And the richest and most prestigious single suburb was Edina. And kids from there and kids from near there said, some of them with pride and some of them with shame, that Edina was famous for having, as they put it, quote, not one Negro and not one Jew. And it didn't either. And I just thought that was outrageous. And then I learned about Darien, Connecticut. And Darien, of course, is one of the richest and most prestigious suburbs of New York City. And in 1947, its exclusionary sundown policies became famous all across the country because the Academy Award-winning movie for that year, for Best Picture, starring Gregory Peck, no less, was Gentlemen's Agreement about the method by which the folks in Darien kept out Jews. And, of course, they kept out blacks. And then I learned about Anna, Illinois. Now, Anna's an independent town down in southern Illinois. Of course, it was named for somebody named Anna in 1854. But in 1909, Anna drove out its black population. And ever since then, it's been known by folks in Anna and by folks in nearby towns as, quote, ain't no niggers allowed, A-N-N-A, unquote. And again, I thought that was outrageous. So at some point, I vowed to write a book about them. But I was completely blindsided by the prevalence of them, by the number of them. And let me tell you, if you don't mind, an aha experience I had while doing the research. It was in October 2001, and I was the headliner of the second annual Decatur, Illinois Writers Conference, because I'm from Decatur, Illinois, an industrial town in the middle of the state, and because, as my teacher told me, my book has been a bestseller. And so I gave a talk on lies my teacher told me. And then at the end of it, I said, well, now I'm doing this research on sundown towns. And I explained what that was. And I said, if anybody knows anything about this subject, won't you come on down afterwards? And to my amazement, 20 people came down. And they told me stories about every little town around Decatur. Now, growing up, I knew these towns were all white. But it never dawned on me that they would be all white on purpose. I figured black folks didn't want to live in these little towns like Niantic or Villa Grove, Illinois. But it turns out that these towns, to every last one of them, had policies and expressed these policies in one way or another. And it was well known, and blacks were simply not allowed to live in them. And then I realized that most all-white towns in America, not all, but most of them, were not all white by accident. They were all white on purpose.
You've already referred to Lies Across America. So much of your scholarship has been on hidden history, and you refer to sundown towns as being hidden in plain view. Why have they been so overlooked in research when you consider the extensive research on race relations in this country? How has that gone missing?
It just amazed me, yeah. I mean, for instance, I think that there are about 10,000 sundown towns in America, and there have also been about roughly 10,000 lynchings. But there have been at least 500 books on lynchings. If you just look up lynchings in the Amazon catalog, if you will, and the Library of Congress catalog, you come up with more than 500 different titles. This is the very first book on sundown towns. And indeed, we've had full-length, book-length biographies, if you will, of some sundown towns that never bothered to mention the fact that the town that this entire community study or history is written about had this policy. So I think in some cases it's absolute suppression. And I talk about cases where the towns do not want it mentioned in print, and they take steps to keep it from being mentioned. In many other cases, white folks, like me, before my eye-opening experience in 2001, white folks are just oblivious. I have to say black folks usually notice the difference. That is, lots of African Americans notice the difference between a 98% white town and a 100% white town. But most non-blacks don't really notice.
So how did you go about researching the topic?
Well, I started with the census. And any town that was all white or almost all white for decade after decade got onto my suspect list. Mm-hmm. Now, I had to watch out for two things. First of all, there's non-household blacks. Like, for instance, Anna, Illinois has about 85 blacks in the year 2000 in the census, of whom about 85 of them are inmates of the Illinois State Mental Hospital.
Oh.
Well, that doesn't keep Anna from being a sundown town, of course, and mm-hmm. prisons will do the same thing, and sometimes colleges. So that was the first thing you have to watch out for. And the second thing you have to watch out for is that a number of sundown towns actually made room for one exception. And it was quite remarkable. Often that exception was the barber, who had largely white clientele.
Mm-hmm.
Pena, Illinois, for instance, drove out its black population in 1899. But they didn't drive out the barber. They didn't have anything against the barber. They liked him. And so if you look at the census in 1900, 1910, 1920, Pena shows 4, 6, or 5 African-American. That's the barber and his family. Meanwhile, Pena goes ahead and posts the notorious sundown town signs at the north, south, east, and west gates to the city. So there's no doubt that it became a sundown town. But you still start with the census. Well, then I always read the community histories, but often they didn't work. I mean, for instance, Anna has a wonderful one called 100 Years of Progress, Anna, Illinois, something like that. It's a coffee table book, 450 pages. It is such a big fat book that it actually has a paragraph on every single business in town, even a paragraph on the local Dairy Queen. Does it mention 1909 when Anna expelled its black population? Does it mention what ANNA has come to mean? Does it mention the fact that Anna posted sundown signs on Route 123 north and south of town? Of course not. But I then went to oral history. When you ask people in Anna, they tell you, especially if you're talking with them face to face. But even on the telephone, people pretty much are open and don't lie. They won't put it in writing, but they will tell you, and they'll tell you with details so that it's believable.
Were informants comfortable talking to you about something like that?
Some were not. Some were very embarrassed. Let me give you an example. I had learned that Villa Grove, Illinois, supposedly had a whistle or a siren that sounded at 6 p.m. every night to tell black folks to be out of town. Now, I thought this was preposterous. I didn't know if you could have a urban legend in a town of 2,500, but I thought if you could, that was an urban legend. It was telling me two things, that Villa Grove had a siren at 6 p.m., probably, I thought, a shift change at a factory or something like that. And it was telling me that these two people who told me this story believed that Villa Grove was a sundown town, and it probably was then, but I couldn't believe it. So a year later, in 2002, I was in Villa Grove, and I went to the Shangri-La Hotel, an SRO, a single-room occupancy hotel for older white men. I was planning to interview some old white men. On my way up the stairs to the hotel, the weekend manager who was sitting on the porch asked me, "Can I help you?" reasonably enough. I said, "Sure." And I told him I was from Decatur and that I heard that Villa Grove, is it true that Villa Grove has a siren or had a siren that sounded at 6 p.m. every night? And he said, "Oh, yes." And I said, "Well, is that on a factory or on a grain elevator?" And he said, "No, no, that's on the water tower." And I said to myself, city property. Isn't that interesting? So then I said, "Well, why did it sound at 6 p.m.? And he said, "You mean originally?" And I said, "Yes, originally." And he said, "Well, originally." And I realized to myself, my God, this is true. Mm-hmm. And so I said to him four words, no content. I didn't want to bias the interview. I said, "It's okay. I know." And he looked relieved and he said, "Well, originally it sounded to tell blacks to be out of town." And I was so astonished, even though I had surmised it, that I wasn't a very good interviewer at that moment. I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, does it still go off?" And he said, "No, no, it stopped about 3 years ago." That would mean it stopped in 1999.
Hmm.
I said, "Well, does that mean that Villa Grove has changed its policy?" Well, he didn't know if Villa Grove had changed its policy or not, but he said, "No, it stopped because residents living near the water tower complained about the noise." And I went on to verify everything he told me with a total of 11 interviews, most on the next Monday when I went back to Villa Grove. But that shows you the reluctance. I mean, he didn't want to spill the beans. But once he realized that the beans had already been spilled, he confirmed it, and he confirmed it with details.
We have time for one more question. Your final chapter you've entitled The Remedy. What are some of the factors that will contribute to removing sundown towns?
Well, I first want to just implore people. I think we need to change this. If you live in an all-white neighborhood, a sundown neighborhood, we might say, or a sundown suburb or a sundown independent town, there's things you can do individually. And so I recommend you read my book and read that last chapter. You can sell your house to a black person and move. That'd be one example. But there are many other examples. And you can also get your state government, or I even think in the current political climate, we can get the federal government to pass what I call a Residents' Rights Act. And just real quickly, this would remove the mortgage interest exemption from our income tax. You know, one of the best reasons to own a house in America is because you get to take off all the money you pay for interest on your mortgage. You don't get to take off rent, but you get to take off interest. That's because home ownership, the federal government and the state governments say, is in the interest of the country. Well, I think it is too, but surely not home ownership by white folks in sundown towns. So if we just remove that exemption for white residents of any sundown town, then suddenly all the residents of the town will clamor for it to open up to everyone so that they can get back their mortgage interest exemption on their income tax form. I think that would solve it right off the bat. And it's an unusual civil rights act in that it wouldn't cost a dime, it would bring in money.
Sundown towns, hidden in plain view, contributed significantly to institutionalizing and reinforcing racism in this country and affecting the lives of countless individuals of all races and religions. We've been talking to James Loewen, author of Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. Thank you, Jim.
It's been fun.
This is Talking History.
Earlier in the show, to mark the beginning of Black History Month, I told you about a new museum exhibit, and a recently released film all related to Black history. We've saved what might be the best for last. Fiona Beatty joins us to tell you about an exhibit about which one reviewer titled her critique, "The Anger and Shock of a City's Slave Past."
The New York Historical Society's exhibit on slavery in New York has been much in the news recently. It has received accolades from the press, historians, and the public. It has also angered some. It reveals what has largely been forgotten, that New York was founded on slavery and dependent upon it for 200 years. Visitors to slavery in New York are compelled to witness a city far different from the one they know and love. Running at over 9,000 square feet, the 10 galleries hold more than 400 artifacts, documents, paintings, and maps. A visitor response booth at the end of the exhibition films their reactions to questions such as how viewing the exhibit changed their perspective. The exhibit, Slavery in New York, closes March 5, 2006. But if you can't visit the exhibition in person, the online exhibit has much to offer the virtual visitor. Download and listen to an interview with Chief Historian of the exhibition, James Horton, or hear Leslie Harris discuss slavery in New York. Structured around 9 galleries, the virtual tour takes visitors on a step-by-step tour of themes, examining how the Atlantic slave trade began, to the Dutch settlement, slavery in British colonial New York, the Revolutionary War, the struggle for black freedom, and the Emancipation Act of 1799. Arranged chronologically, each section provides a brief explanation and illustrations. Classroom materials for teachers are provided in downloadable PDF form, including fact sheets, glossaries, photo cards, and other materials. To find out more, go to slaveryinnewyork.org.
And finally, as promised, Michael Farquhar is back for part 7 in his 10-part series of readings from his new book, A Treasury of Deception: Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. This week he reads from part 7 of his book, The Deadliest Lies Ever Told, from a chapter he has titled The Blood Libel.
On the day before Easter, 1144, the body of a 12-year-old boy named William was found in a forest just outside Norwich, England. Though there were signs of violence on the young apprentice, his death would have been unremarkable in an age when a child's life was often short and brutal. But a zealous monk named Thomas of Monmouth made William a martyr when he claimed the boy was murdered by Jews in a gruesome ritual that mocked the crucifixion of Jesus. Most historians agree that Thomas's tale was the seed from which grew what Professor Alan Dundees calls one of the most bizarre and dangerous legends ever created by the human imagination. The widespread belief that Jews routinely killed Christian children in secret rituals, commonly called the blood libel, has endured for nearly 9 centuries, influenced anti-Semites from Martin Luther to Adolf Hitler, and caused untold misery to millions of innocent people over the ages. Despite the obvious absurdities in Thomas of Monmouth's story of William the Martyr, it quickly gained currency throughout England. Soon other accusations of Jewish ritual murder popped up across the kingdom, including the tale of Little St. Hugh of Lincoln, to whom Chaucer paid tribute in his Prioress's tale. The blood libel meshed well with other medieval superstitions about Jews, devils in disguise, it was said, who poisoned wells, corrupted children, and of course killed Christ. After incubating in England, the slur gradually infected the rest of Europe, where horrific images of ritual murder may still be seen in the paintings and stained glass windows of some churches across the continent. Persecution inevitably followed the story wherever it spread. In 1492, for example, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain ordered the expulsion of all the Jews residing in their kingdom. Some historians say the religiously motivated act was prompted in part by reports of an infant sacrificed by Jews several years before. Torquemada, Spain's infamous Inquisitor General, took a special interest in that case, which resulted in 8 people burned at the stake before wildly cheering crowds. Throughout the rest of the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, and the Industrial Revolution, the blood libel clung to the popular consciousness like a poisonous leech. And it wasn't just ignorant peasants who spread the tales of human sacrifice, but priests, professors, and politicians who kept the spirit of William of Norwich alive around the world.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beattie is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.